In connection with the festival of Hanukkah, you may recall there is an interesting miracle reported by the rabbis, how when they came to rededicate the temple in Jerusalem, they found one cruse of sacred oil, which was to burn only one day, and by a miracle, it burned for 8 days. I want to speak this morning of another miracle, which is recorded in the Bible. In the book of Kings, there is recorded a strange miracle which was performed by the prophet Elisha, the disciple of the great Elijah. Elisha came again to Gilgal, we read in the book of Kings, and there was a famine in the land. And the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, Elisha, and he said unto his servant, set on the great pot and boil pottage for the sons of the prophets. And one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered thereof wild gourds his lapful. And then he came and he shred them into the pot of pottage. Then he poured out for the men to eat. And as they were eating of the pottage, they cried out, O man of God, there is death in the pot. Whereupon Elisha said, then bring me meal. And he cast the meal into the pot. And then he said, pour out for the people that they may eat. And they ate, and there was no harm in the pot. Now, miracles, dear friends, should not be explained or rationalized, for in so doing, they cease to be miracles. They belong to the ancient poetry of religion and to the childhood of the human race. But this particular miracle always intrigued me by its imagery and by what it may suggest about the conduct of human life. Here a member of the school of prophets, which was presided over by Elisha, goes out into the field to gather herbs so that a pot of pottage could be boiled for the members of this prophetic fraternity so that they could eat, for there was famine in the land. And he gathers a lap full of wild goods, cuts them up and boils them in the pot, and he pours out the pottage for the men to eat. And suddenly the men cry out, why, O man of God, there is death in the pot. What was meant to be food to sustain life turned out to be poison. Elisha then said, bring me meal. And he threw it into the pot and said, pour out for the men that they may eat. There was no longer any harm in the pot. Obviously, something was added to the pottage which was not previously present, something which acted as a sort of an antidote and turn death into life. And without that something, that which was intended to be food proved to be poison. Now I suggest that Elisha's miracle is not an uncommon one. It occurs frequently, though infrequently observed. Very often men and women gather, sometimes at great cost, they gather all the ingredients for a happy life. And lo and behold, there is death in the pot. Something had been omitted. Something had been forgotten, overlooked. Something so essential that what was to be life-giving and happiness-yielding turns out to be frustration and sorrow and defeat. Many a human life lacks a certain substance, which substance, acting like a spiritual catalysis, could bring about a happy union of the many elements which compose human life. I'm thinking in the moment of the most unhappy man in the Bible. No, it's not Job. For though Job suffered much, grievously, and complained much, he ended his days in peace, restored in fortune, and reconciled in faith. And his doubts and questionings and his rebellion were finally resolved into a humble, peaceful acquiescence and acceptance of the ways of providence, ways which are often beyond man's understanding, too wonderful for him. No, Job is not the unhappiest man in the Bible. The unhappiest man of the Bible is Ecclesiastes, Koheleth, son of David, king of Jerusalem. He hated life, he declared. He hated life. His heart was always full of despair. He saw no profit in anything that he was doing. He found everything pointless, wearisome, repetitious, and a striving after wind. It were better, he said, it were better not to have been born at all. Now, was Koheleth a slave that he complained so much? Was he blind or lame or otherwise afflicted? Was he ever afflicted like Job? Well, no, not at all. He was a king. He had great power and vast treasures of silver and gold. He had made great works and builded many houses and palaces and planted many vineyards. He had many men servants and maid servants and enjoyed all the delights of the sons of man. He denied himself nothing. Was he an ignorant man? Why, no. He had gotten great wisdom and knowledge, more than all that were before him over Jerusalem. He had applied his heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the reason of things. But that too he found to be a sore task and a weariness of the flesh for in much wisdom he found much vexation. And he concluded that he that increaseth knowledge increases sorrow. Now there is another book of the Bible, the book of Proverbs, where we find another and a quite different evaluation of man's quest for knowledge and wisdom. In the book of Proverbs you read, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gets understanding. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. My son, keep sound wisdom. If you sit down, you will not be afraid. And when you lie down, your sleep will be sweet, for the Lord will be your confidence. Now, wherein is this difference in these two conflicting attitudes towards wisdom and the acquisition of knowledge? The author of the book of Proverbs believes that the beginning of wisdom is reverence of God. Reshit Chokhmah Yirat Adonai. And he sees as the essence of wisdom doing good in the world. And so he says, do not withhold good from those to whom it is due when it is in your power to do it. Do not say to your neighbor, go and come again tomorrow. Tomorrow I will give it when you have it with you today. What was wrong with Koheleth? Having everything, why did he seem to lack everything? What one thing had been omitted from his makeup, which turned everything he touched, everything he acquired, everything he wrought, everything he engaged into, turned into grief, into cinders, into ashes, into dust? Why were all his days, as he says, pain, his work, vexation? Why even in the night did his heart take no rest? Why was there death in the pot? It was not that Koheleth had omitted God from his life. Koheleth was not an atheist or an agnostic. He believed in God. And unlike Job, he did not argue with God nor demand an accounting. He believed in God, but in a God who was not particularly concerned with him, with his life, with his doings. A God who created the world, fixed its laws, and let it go at that. In the order of this world, which God created, in its moral order, as in its physical order, nothing could be changed. That was the conviction of Koheleth. Nothing could be changed. Just as the sun rises and sets and rises again, just as the wind blows and turns about continually in its circuit, just as the rivers run into the sea and the sea is never full, so the generations of men come and go upon the earth. That which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done. That which is crooked can never be made straight, and that which is wanting can never be made up. Koheleth was convinced that whatever God does or did is done forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. That which is has been long ago, and that which is to be has already been. There is nothing new under the sun. nothing new in the universe, or in man, or in society. This, of course, is not true. The history of man over long periods of time has not been fixed or static. The history of man has been a record of steady growth and progress, of climbing from lower degrees to higher degrees. What was omitted from Gehenna's life was the belief not in God, but the belief in a demanding God, in a God who calls man to act, in a God who assigned tasks for human beings, to seek justice, to pursue righteousness, to loose the chains of wickedness, to undo the bonds of the yoke, to break every yoke, to bring the prisoner out of the dungeon and out of the prison house, them who dwell in darkness. What was missing in his life was a strong conviction which interfuses, if it's there, one's entire being, which becomes an impulse, a motive, and a mandate, which makes one the willing servant of the compelling idea. What was omitted from the banquet of the pampered, surfeited, and resigned life of this sovereign, who had tasted everything in life? This intensive individualist and egoist, what was omitted was the chalice of courage and dedication. Nothing had ever stabbed his spirit broad awake to realize that it was his duty and his opportunity to try to make straight that which was crooked in the world about him and to supply what was wanting. He had closed his heart to the challenge of God, who summons man to be his co-worker in creation. Koheleth never knew what it was to hunger and thirst after righteousness. He sought for peace of mind and for meaning and dignity where they could never be found. In a restless quest after pleasures, and in the pursuit of knowledge which remained forever untouched by the burning coal of mission and challenge to help others. Koheleth saw the oppression of the poor all around him, and the violent perverting of justice in the state, he says so himself. But it charged it all up to the Almighty, and that's where the matter ended for him. He did not come down from his throne and did not go out from the gates of his palace to correct the evil which he knew to exist. He was content to absolve himself of all responsibility for what was happening all about him and leave it all to God. I said in my heart, the virtuous and the wicked, God will judge. Koheleth himself never fought the good fight. Why then should he be expected to find any victories in life? What reforms did he attempt to introduce? What evils did he set out to undo? If he had tried, and even if he failed, he would never have felt so utterly woe-begone and bereft. Now, Qu'Elet was not a wicked man. He lacked one thing. He lacked the sacred fire. There was one single blind spot in his vision, in his spiritual vision. Something basic had been omitted from his life. Something that would have been the catalysis, the solder, the cement. Something which would have held the pieces of his life together, given it pattern. The driving God, the dynamics of moral purpose, the summoning voice of duty, that was not there. It was not there to arouse him and to disturb him. Had they been there, Qu'Elet would not have been so much concerned that his garment should always be white and that his head should never lack any oil. He would undoubtedly have experienced much exhaustion while working in spotted garments alongside of his fellow men, building the city of God. But in the night, his heart would have been at rest and his sleep would have been sweet. His days would have known pride, dignity, moments of lift, and moments of ecstasy. Now, my good friends, there are other compensations which accrue to those who do not omit what I call this driving God from their lives. Such men can afford to be different. And he'd never be afraid. Once a man permits this kind of a God to guide him, once a man links up his destiny with the purposes of such a God, he will be afraid of no one. He will not have to conform out of fear of antagonizing men. With God, a man can stand alone. Without him, a man must seek security in conformity, or he is entirely lost. Consult the pages of our history. When the children of Israel were loyal to their God, who was always a demanding and an exacting God, an Elkanah, they knew themselves to be invincible. They were not afraid to be different or to stand alone. Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear or be in dread of them. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. But time and again, the people, when they were disloyal to this God, they became afraid to stand alone and to be different. When, for example, they became afraid of the powerful Philistines and their iron chariots, which were new in those days, they clamored at once for a king to rule over them. They rejected God from being king over them. They cried out, Sima lanu melech leshafteinu kechol hagoyim. Appoint for us a king to govern us like all the other nations. Like all the other nations. Vehayinu gam anachnu kechol hagoyim. That we also may be like all the nations. Conformity. Whenever the people succumbed to the allurements of their environments and could not abide by their austere faith and the demands of his exalted ethical code, they would cry out, let us be like all the other nations, like the tribes of the countries about us. Let us too worship wood and stone. On Hanukkah, we are reminded of one man who dared to be different and to stand alone because he had not omitted this challenging, this demanding God from his life. His name was Mattathias, and he lived at a time of great political turmoil and spiritual chaos. Many Jews were falling away from their religion. They were attracted by the Hellenistic culture and civilization which the conquering Greeks had introduced into Asia Minor and into Palestine. And all the other conquered peoples had adopted the ways of the Greeks. And so many Jews too wanted to be like them in all things, even though the Greek way of life was far inferior to the demands of the Mosaic law and the traditional moral standards of the Jewish people. And so when King Antiochus determined for political reasons to suppress the Jewish faith altogether and so achieve a complete amalgam of all the peoples of his empire, many Jews readily acquiesced. Not so Mattathias the Hasmonean, the priest from Modin. He dared to stand alone. But Mattathias answered and spake with a loud voice, though all the nations that are under the king's dominion obey him and fall away each from the religion of his fathers, yet will I and my sons, my brethren, continue to walk in the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law to depart from our faith either to the right hand or to the left. Then Mattathias cried throughout the city with a loud voice, saying, whosoever is zealous of the law and maintains the covenant, let him follow me. So he and his sons fled into the mountains, and they went about pulling down the heathen altars, and they rescued the law out of the hands of the Gentiles. And his valiant son, Judah, called the Maccabee, followed his example. He also dared to stand alone, secure in his faith, in this demanding and challenging God. When all the people feared and trembled at the sight of the great number of the enemy and said, what shall we be able, being a small company, to fight against so great and so strong a multitude? Judah answered, with the God of heaven, it is all one to save by many or by few. And Judah led them into battle, and behold, the hosts of the enemy were discomfited before them, and Israel had a great deliverance. Now these men, Mattathias, Judah, and the few who followed them, these men did not say with Koheleth, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Why resist the Greeks? Why fight? Why sacrifice? What difference does it make? What has been is what will be. What is crooked can never be made straight. And who will ever remember what we do anyhow? No, Mattathias, Judah did not say that. These men fought like lions for faith and freedom, for covenant and heritage. The few fought against the many, the weak against the strong. Because an undeniable and unresistible command had come from them, from their demanding God, whom they did not omit from their lives, even as their strength derived from him. And what they achieved was not forgotten. To this day and throughout the world, candles of light are kindled in their honor. Their memorial has not perished. Their memorial has endured throughout all the generations for their brave deeds of faith and courage and sacrifice preserved the noble ethical and spiritual heritage of their people for the whole of mankind. My dear friends, have you ever asked yourselves what has been omitted from your life? It's a searching question to ask yourself. And everyone should ask himself that question. For no life is complete, no life. Are you aware of some great omission, some gap, some void? Are you afraid that your life is adding up to a lap full of wild gourds from which that little handful of meal is missing, which alone can neutralize the harmful poisons? Do you find yourself, though living in a world of plenty, steadily growing empty, drained, and drifting into a psychic malaise of listlessness, or into an even more dangerous mood, of frustration and cynicism, misanthropy? What is it that you have omitted from your life? Is it love that you have omitted from your life? A love which can hold the pieces of your life together, give your life pattern and dignity, meaning? Is it kindness or compassion that you've omitted from your life and so fragmentized your life? Or forgiveness, or justice, or truth? Is there some one handful of meal, of sacred meal, that you have overlooked or forgotten in your rush through life, which is turning everything that you're acquiring or have acquired into something very distasteful and harmful and lethal? Well, our people grouped all these love and kindness and compassion and forgiveness and justice and truth, all these spiritual qualities, our people group them all together. For they're all facets of one unchangeable and indispensable essence, which alone can hold our life together, make it beautiful, meaningful. Israel grouped them all together and called them Adonai, Adonai, God, God, the demanding God, the challenging God, also the strengthening God and the comforting God, the holy God.